Welcome to How I Raised It, the podcast that goes behind the scenes with entrepreneurs who've raised capital. We uncover the tips, tricks, and techniques they use to get investors to write a check. Strap in and turn it up.
Hi, welcome to another episode of How I Raised It, produced by FounderSuite.com. Today I have Susan Ho of Journey coming to us from New York. How's it going, Susan?
Doing well. Thanks for having me, Nathan.
Is it full, you know, holiday season in New York with Rockefeller Center and everything going on? Or are you too buried down, heads down on startup?
I wouldn't know.
Yeah.
I'm sure it is, but I wouldn't know.
That was a test. That's the right answer. Your investors are paying attention. Make sure you're not out ice skating. Good. Cool. Well, tell us about Journey. What do you guys do?
Yeah, so Journey is a mobile app and web platform. We pair you with your own personal trip designer to plan every aspect of your trip. That includes your hotel, your activities, your restaurants. One of the things that we really focus on is the traveler who travels for food. 98% of our travelers say that food and beverages are one of the top reasons that they travel. So my co-founder, with her background, she hosts the Red Carpet Awards for the James Beard Awards and the World's 50 Best Restaurant Awards. Through her connections, we've put together a database of over 300 top chefs, local experts, where those recommendations are coming from. And we're also, because of that, able to get people unique access into some of the best restaurants in the world. So you want to go to 11 Madison Park here in New York City, and you miss the reservation window, we're your best shot of getting in. And on top of that, we are a super affordable model in that we charge $25 per day of your trip for just the basic travel plan, and then $50 per day of your trip if you're also asking us for help with your restaurant reservations and making all of your hotel and tour and activity bookings on your behalf.
Cool. So $25 per day or $50 for the premium plan, basically.
Exactly.
Yeah, I was going to ask if you are able to get people into things that they otherwise couldn't access. It sounds like you
yep.
can, at least.
One of the prime reasons that people come to us, yeah.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting. One of my friends started a startup. Do you remember Table 8? Did you ever come across a startup called Table 8?
Yes, I remember Table 8. Yep.
Yeah, it didn't ultimately work out, but he worked on it pretty hard for a while. And that was kind of, I guess, just the restaurant focus of getting in reservations where you couldn't get in. I don't know how the model worked beyond that, but definitely kind of a...
Yeah, I mean, we definitely ran some tests ourselves around that model. And what we found is that the sense of urgency of getting into a restaurant when you live in that city is not high enough to make people want to pay for it. And so, but if it's something where, you know, that person is in Copenhagen, they're in Copenhagen for only 3-4 days. They've just spent all this money on their flight and their hotel, and they're really dying to go to Noma or one of the top restaurants in Copenhagen. That's when they're willing to shell out some money and also have us put together a more broad plan for them so that you map out, like, here's a great breakfast spot near my hotel. Here's what I can do in the morning. Here's a great lunch spot. Here's an afternoon spot. Here's, you know, dinner, here's an after dinner cocktail bar, and really, you know, planning that out in a logistically optimized way so that they can easily go from one place to another and not have to spend all this time in transit. It's one of the things that we specialize in.
Yeah. Interesting. And do you also get kickbacks? I mean, the traditional travel agent is mainly paid by the airlines and things like that. Are you taking a little on that side too?
So we do have relationships with hotels, where, you know, we're getting commission from hotels. But in general, on the restaurant side, we never take any sort of kickbacks from the restaurants. We will take some, commissions from activities where, you know, hey, we've just booked the same things over and over and over again. It makes sense for us to negotiate with that supplier. But at the same time, you know, on our trip planning fees today alone, we're earning a 55% gross margin. And so because we're able to make money just off of that, we actually don't care if the traveler books, you know, any activities with us. We just care if they have a good time. And so, you know, one of the things that's different about us in a typical travel agency is that we really can help people figure out how to allocate their dollars in a way that more closely aligns with their values and where they want to spend money, right? So we'll have travelers who are staying in an Airbnb, but then they're going to Tokyo and they want to spend $300 on a high-end sushi omakase, right? A typical travel agent will say, great, you're a high-end person. Here's a $500 a night hotel. Here's all these tours and stuff like that that I bundled up for you. And by the way, the total price per person for your trip is going to be $10,000. And you have no idea how that money is allocated across the activities.
Yeah, that makes sense. Interesting. And how long have you guys been around and how many cities and what are some of the key, you know, metrics, data points?
Yeah, so we launched in June of 2016. We're currently live in 75 destinations around the world. And we're continuing to grow that every quarter.
That's great. Do you get involved? Have you been into all 75 destinations planning the, you know,
be a fun job. Almost all of them, almost all of them, but not quite. And that's one of the unique aspects of our model where, you know, we're relying on local experts who live in Paris, who live in Japan, you know, who live in Copenhagen. Like the people who are providing our recommendations for Copenhagen, you know, are some of the front of house team at Noma, one of the top restaurants in the world, right? So that's kind of the benefit of our model as well, in that that's what makes it affordable for people.
Yeah, that sounds cool. And what's your backstory? We heard about your co-founder who was doing the Top Chef stuff. How did you come to this, or how did you guys come to this idea together?
Yeah, so I started my career at the Boston Consulting Group here in New York. And then in April of 2012, it's actually my co-founder who introduced me to Beth Ferreira, who was the COO of Fab.com. So I joined Fab.com in 2012 when it was about 100 employees. I was there until it grew to 700 employees and then back down to 100 employees. At the height of the company, I was 25 years old, managing a team of 120 people across New York and Berlin that I had built myself. And so, you know, I then became the youngest VP on the team. I was VP of operations strategy and customer service. And, you know, just, I'm sure anybody in the New York startup ecosystem has heard the story of Fab and the, you know, the biggest e-commerce fail of all time, essentially. But for me, it was an incredible learning experience and glimpse into just how quickly, you know, startups can grow and, you know, how quickly I was able to get a lot of responsibility and, you know, gain in my career within a year and a half what would normally take someone 5 to 10 years to get experience in.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I remember Fab. It was quite a rocket ship for a while. That's pretty exciting.
Yeah.
Very good. So let's talk about fundraising for Journey. How much you guys raised over how many rounds?
So we did a pre-seed round of about $600,000. Then we did an extension of that of $335,000. And then we just raised our full seed round of $3.15 million. So we've raised almost about $4 million at this point.
Congrats. And when you were doing the pre-seed, did you have a working app? Were you in a certain number of cities? Kind of what were you pitching?
No. So when we did our pre-seed round, essentially, I had started working on Journey full-time in February of 2015. And it was just me in my apartment manually planning trips for people. So my riskiest assumption at the time was essentially that, hey, you know, is it even possible to plan high-quality trips for people when I've never spoken to them on the phone and I've just asked them a set of 10 questions, right? And so that was the first test. And I planned the first 70 trips and had amazing feedback from travelers. You know, built the first landing page myself, learned HTML and CSS, and then put some Google ads against it to see if we could get at least a 2% conversion rate of people giving us an email address for this type of service. Because I knew if they wouldn't even give us an email address, there's no way they would give us the credit card information. Passed that test, and then you know, put up a Stripe integration, and people started paying us $50 per trip plan. That's when I went out and I raised our pre-seed round of funding, and it was one of our early customers who was an entrepreneur who we planned a trip to Mexico City for, who absolutely loved our service and just, you know, saw the potential in it despite the incredibly MVP nature of our product to date, and introduced us to a number of his investors. And I think at that point I spent about a month fundraising. I was taking only 1 or 2 meetings a week. And, you know, I closed $600,000 and actually, you know, had to say no to a few investors. We actually had commitments of up to $1.3 million at that point. But in talking to, you know, two of the top investors that I knew for sure I wanted in the round, their advice was, hey, you know, we don't think raising, you know, $1.3 million is going to get you to your Series A. We think a better strategy is to raise a smaller pre-seed round, and, you know, really anything over 750K, you can't really consider a pre-seed. And then, you know, take that pre-seed to build the actual product and then raise, you know, another $1.5 million to solely do customer acquisition. Right. And I would say that's probably one of the things that I regret. I regret not taking the money sooner. And so advice to entrepreneurs out there is, if you have the opportunity to raise more money, raise more money. It always takes more capital than you think it's going to.
Yes. Very true. Very interesting. Great. And so how did you like turn or flip the customer into kind of a connector slash investor? Did you just put it out to your customers? Hey, we're raising money. Does anyone want to come in?
Yeah. I mean, a lot of my early customers were friends or friends of friends. Mm-hmm. And so this was a person who was in my business fraternity at Wharton undergrad, and who, you know, was definitely, you know, a few years older than me and had done it before. He'd raised $40 million for his startup. And so, you know, he was one, incentivized to help from the network standpoint, and two, you know, just really deeply loved the product and used it multiple times and was a great advocate for it and knew exactly what type of investors to introduce me to so that I wasn't wasting my time, right? I think that's the biggest mistake that entrepreneurs make is you know, spending time with investors that are not at the right stage or interested in, you know, the industry or the space that you're playing in.
Yeah. So did you identify travel focused investors? Did you find a list out there? Did you build a list? How did you kind of?
I did that over time. And, you know, it kind of had its hit or misses because when it comes to travel, everybody says that they're interested in travel, but the VC community really over the last, you know, decade or so has gotten really burnt out from travel startups. Other than Airbnb and some B2B travel startups, there's really nothing that's, you know, gotten to the scale that people had hoped. There were a lot of travel darlings early in the day, like Hipmunk, like Hotel Tonight, where at scale, the consumer unit economics just really didn't pan out and customer acquisitions, you know, increasingly becoming expensive. And so there wasn't a lot in our favor being a consumer startup. And so for us, what's interesting is that, you know, when we launched our product in June of 2016, I went out and I tried to raise a round, ran a process, had one of our lead investors from our pre-seed round, who was very well connected, introduced me to, you know, 80 something investors that I had conversations with. And we just struck out every time. And it was a situation where this was an industry that people were, you know, really still reeling from, and have had a lot of bad experiences in. And, you know, we were so new and we didn't have the data or the metrics to sway or prove them otherwise that this was actually an interesting, space to invest in. You know, I had investors who I went back to this recent round of fundraising who now, you know, I'm telling them, hey, we have 55%, you know, gross margins on our business. We have 60%+ net margins on the business. Here's what that looks like and here's how we've been able to do it. And who have said to me, wow, when you first showed me this back in 2016, I thought that it was never going to make money. And that was the mentality then, right? Because we didn't have the proof point, because we were in this industry that wasn't a darling, that you know, didn't have the wind in its sails. It was basically impossible at that point for me to raise money, even though I had a product that was, you know, like beautiful, that customers loved, and that, you know, we had customers who were coming back and booking with us again and again. At that point in 2016, you know, one of our most avid customers had used Journey 18 times in the last 6 months, but it still just wasn't enough. And so, you know, I remember this is towards the end of 2016. We were filming for a TV show produced by Apple called Planet of the Apps. We had gotten Gary Vaynerchuk as an advisor, and so we were filming on the show. The producers are, you know, flying us out to LA to film. One of our investors is like, hey, come out a day early and you know, meet some investors here because I'm throwing a party at my house. So I fly out there a day early, and I remember realizing, holy crap, I have $50 in my bank account and I don't know where I'm staying tonight because the show is paid for my hotel for the next day, but not for today. What does my life come to? And I remember talking to this investor and just basically, you know, I'm on the verge of tears, and he, you know, tells me, hey, you know, it's not going to get any worse than this. And, you know, if you wanted to, if you woke up one day and you said, hey, you know, like I gave it my all and this is just, isn't working out. You know, we're going to understand and you're going to have a huge weight lifted off of your shoulders. But if you stick with it and it actually works, you are going to feel so incredibly amazing and nothing will stop you after that. Right. So it was a really good decision that I went out there and took the risk, actually, because it was at that event that I met one of the founders of 500 Startups who put us in his Series A program. And it was that program where every single day they had a different growth expert come in who was somebody who had built a double-digit million-dollar-plus business using nothing but you know, content marketing, email marketing, on-site optimization, you know, video advertising, YouTube advertising, mobile advertising, SEO, SEM, you name it, whatever strategy, whatever growth hacking strategy that's out there. We had, you know, somebody come in and not only talk about how they applied it, but also sit with us one-on-one to talk about what experiments could we run for our business and see if we really get traction with this. And so basically from there, we implemented this really, you know, fast scale of experimentation. Like, we have experiment sheets where in 1 month you can see we ran 70 to 90 experiments to just figure out, hey, what's going to unlock our growth. And the thing that we hit on was tiering our pricing and splitting out our pricing model from a flat rate of $25 per day to $25 and $50 per day. And essentially what we did was we doubled our price. But what it did was it illustrated the value proposition to the customer in a much more clear way. And so you can basically see from the time when we implemented that to the time when we raised money, we 5X'd our business. Mm-hmm. And our unit economics became super healthy. And so when I went out to raise our actual seed round, it wasn't at all like the process that I ran in 2016, where I was striking out when talking to 80 something investors. The good news was that a lot of those investors, you know, had a really good impression of me and my background, and so stayed in touch. And so when I updated them around the business, there were a few that were really excited to meet. And so I was able to prioritize, hey, here are the people that I think are going to be closest to saying yes. So I went out to SF from New York. I had 2 days of meetings on Thursday and Friday, 9 meetings in total, and ended up getting a term sheet on Monday from one firm. And that ultimately ended up leading our round, Menlo Ventures. Ended up, you know, getting an offer for a term sheet from another firm. And then on Wednesday, an offer for a term sheet from yet another firm. And so because we had done the work and we knew from our past failures in raising money, what investors were going to look for, what questions they were going to have, you know, what they were going to challenge in the business, we were able to address all of those things head on, and we had an incredibly smooth process the second time around.
Yeah. Wow. Okay. I've got multiple follow-up questions because it's okay. All good stuff. When you were first, you know, your first attempt at raising that seed where you're talking to 80 folks, like, did you know when it was time to just like pull back and, or do you kind of exhaust your list and talk to everyone? And then, you know, I guess, because this is one of the things that I think comes up with a lot of startups, right? They go out fundraising and for whatever reason, it becomes clear it's not going to happen. So when do you sort of retrench versus keep going ahead? Yeah.
I mean, I would have done things differently and I did do things differently the second time around. So, I mean, I went and I powered through because so many people had told me, hey, you know, you just need, you know, one person to say yes, right? So keep going and keep powering through this list because you never know. But I think that's not necessarily true when, you know, you're hearing the same things over and over again. And you know, it's tough to get somebody to believe in this. And, you know, luckily we did get somebody to believe enough in it such that we were able to raise a bridge round, right? We were able to raise a bridge round of $335,000, which was no small feat at that time. But in terms of raising from institutional VCs, it was something that really, you know, wasn't going anywhere. And I could see that. And so I essentially at the end of that process pivoted from trying to raise money from institutional VCs to going more towards, you know, some angel investors. So other than 500 startups, which is actually an institutional VC, but just structured a little bit differently in that they have an accelerator program. You know, we raised money from Andrew Zimmern, the Travel Channel host of Bizarre Foods. Somebody who my co-founder, Leyte, you know, knew from being on the red carpet at food award events, right? And saying, wow, this person is actually right up our alley. Let's go after it. And, you know, it really was. And then going through an angel network where there were individuals who, you know, were writing 10K or 25K checks to us, right? So that was kind of a necessary thing to realize that the VC route wasn't going to work for our stage of business at the time, but that there were angels that were willing to take a chance on us. And I would say,
sorry to interrupt, did you label it a bridge round, or did you just say we're just doing another angel tranche here? Or like, how did you kind of
we didn't even position it as a bridge round. We positioned it to those angels as, hey, you know what, we're going to give you the exact same terms as our pre-seed round. So you are going to get the same terms as people who invested before we ever built a product. And our early investors were okay with that because, frankly, you know, they were shocked that we're still around. They actually told me that and said, you know, we all expected that you would have given up by now, but you didn't. And so they were perfectly okay with me offering the same terms to newer investors.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And so you just labeled it basically an extension of the pre-seed, something like that?
There wasn't any labeling. Literally, with our lawyers, it was like, hey, we're just going to add some more investors to the documentation that we had for our last round.
Gotcha. And did you, just in terms of like kind of thinking about it, did you go back to the first set of investors first, or did you just go out and find some fresh blood?
For the extension, you mean?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I mean, for the extension, yeah, we had to go out and find brand new investors because the way, you know, VC funds are structured, it really is that, you know, they're looking for a certain level of growth and traction for them to invest more, right? Yeah. And that level of ownership that our initial two lead investors got at the pre-seed round, you know, hit their ownership targets. And so there was no sense if the valuation was staying the same for them to put in more money because they had already hit their ownership target.
Good. Okay. So I love this story. So then you know, you get in 500 startups, Series A program, doing all these experiments, you find some things that are working. Did you know from making the rounds, you know, at that seed attempt, what your metrics specifically needed to be in terms of growth or margins, monthly revenue? Did you kind of have what?
Nobody would tell me specifically, but in my head, I had 100K MRR. And we hit that. We hit pretty much close to that. We did about, with our core business, $80,000 to $90,000 a month in revenue when we went out and raised our actual seed round. And at the time, we did that, we posted a $35,000 net income for the quarter. So not only that, not only did we hit our kind of revenue target, but we also proved that we could be profitable. So it was many, many things at the same time. Another thing for our business that was an open question that we knew we needed to solve was this question of repeat rates and travel. Because, you know, it's leisure travel, people take maybe one big vacation a year. What is the LTV? What's the repeat rate look like? And we just said, we need to take that question mark out of the equation. And the way we do that is by being profitable on first transaction. So because on first transaction, we're earning, you know, 60% net margin, it doesn't matter what the repeat rate is. The repeat rate just ends up being gravy. And that's how we solved for this early question mark that, you know, we didn't have enough history in the business to be able to solve, right?
Yeah, that's good. And how about just general month over month growth? What were some of the expectations you at least maybe had in your own head of what you needed to be showing
for that?
I mean, at the time we closed, we were basically doing like 30 to 40% quarter over quarter in terms of growth. Sure. So, yeah, it was definitely, you know, something where once things were working, we kind of hit the gas pedal on it and we pushed more on what was working until we got to the level of metrics that we thought made sense. And even at that point in time, we already had some, a few VCs who were following us, who, you know, were looking to kind of preempt our process of raising. And I think that that's something that entrepreneurs need to be very diligent about and saying no to, and not letting an individual VC preempt your process. Because what you want to do is you want to, you know, get a bunch of VCs at the same time, you know, getting exposed to your company and your business. So there's a sense of competition for it. You know, otherwise, there's no urgency for them to make a decision. Right.
Yeah.
So, even though I had people chasing me, I multiple times said, hey, no, it's not a good time. We're heads down right now. Let's loop back in a couple months from now.
Would you keep them updated via a newsletter or anything, or were you pretty much just, we're quiet until we're ready to raise money?
I would jump on, you know, update calls with them and kind of verbally give them some updates and metrics and, you know, tell them what was working for us. But that's pretty much it. Yeah. The ones that were interested. Yeah.
Cool. Great. And then maybe talk, so going back to the seed round, you set up a bunch of, you kind of knew your metrics were looking good. You're in a better place. You know, maybe talk about creating that competition and the heat that sounds like you're able to achieve when you came out to San Francisco for that trip.
Yeah. So, you know, first before I even set up or planned any meetings, I actually took our deck to some people who I knew were never going to invest in travel and who, you know, didn't like travel. And, you know, some of these investors were people that I had pitched to early on, and, you know, they had passed on us because it was too early. But, you know, I could tell that they, you know, believed in me. And so I basically said, hey, you know, I'm going and I'm starting a fundraising process. You had some really good advice, you know, the last time we spoke around what it would take to make this business attractive for you to invest in. Can I take some of your time and get your feedback on our deck? And essentially I would, you know, run through the pitch with them, and, you know, they would kind of be very honest with me about, hey, here's where there's still open question marks around, you know, this aspect of your business or your customer acquisition costs. You know, there's this question of, are you a competitor to, are you disrupting the traditional travel agency space, or is this something totally brand new where, you know, you're pursuing this AI machine learning model that is a very different type of company, right? And how do you become clear on which one you are and which opportunity you're going after, right? So a lot of these questions really, really helped shape and frame how we presented our story and how we presented our vision for the company, because, you know, I was always clear on where we wanted to be. But I realized that a lot of times in figuring out how you translate that message to investors in a clear and succinct way, where, you know, as an entrepreneur, I've been thinking about this business every day, every second, you know, for the last 3 years. I'm expecting in a 20-minute conversation for an investor to understand all of that.
Yeah.
That's an incredibly challenging thing to do, right? And so taking the time to get that initial feedback from people to understand where it was that my story wasn't landing with them, and figuring out how to tweak that message so that they did understand all of the thinking and process that went into me saying, this is our plan, and this is why we're doing it this way, and this is why, you know, we're doing this first and then this second, in a way that, you know, it would really make sense to investors, and they would understand how we were being thoughtful about the business. You know, it took a lot of time and iteration to do, right? It probably took me, you know, a few weeks to just put together the first initial shell deck, another, you know, 2 to 3 weeks of getting feedback from about 5 or 6 different investors that I trusted to give me feedback, and then hiring a designer to help illustrate some of the concepts that we were looking at in a much clearer way, and then, you know, iterating, doing another round of iterations from there, and then going out and fundraising, mm-hmm. right? A lot of the investment was just around how do I make sure that the story that I'm telling matches, is reflective and honest and true to, you know, what I've been thinking in my head for the last 3 years.
Yeah. I used to do pitch decks for startups, and then when I did my own pitch deck, it's much harder to do your own pitch deck sometimes, because exactly what you just described there, you've got almost too much in your head.
Yeah. Know? Yeah. What's important, you know, what is, you know, somebody really going to respond to, and you know, what is something that you feel like is super fleshed out and obvious, but is actually not to someone else. That's where, you know, I spent the most time.
Yeah. Good stuff. So just as an aside, did you get on Planet of the Apps show? Did you make the cut, or?
No, I mean, we did make the cut in the sense that actually all four judges swiped right on us. Hey, hey. but ultimately our episode never aired. So that's unfortunate, but there was also, it's not controversial for me to say this. It was very poor planning on Apple's part. They were supposed to release a mobile app, never released a mobile app. The actual show was very hard to find in the context of iTunes, all of these things. And so, I think ultimately there were a lot of issues with the rollout. I will say that, it was really helpful for us to have Gary as an advisor, because essentially he pushed us to hustle and just go out and get customers. At that time in our business, you know, people weren't converting on our site. Our messaging around our product wasn't very clear on site. And so we ended up just picking up the phones and calling everyone we knew and explaining the product and understanding directly from each person what they needed in terms of reassurance to trust that this was a product that could plan their trip to perfection. And, you know, in that sprint where we, you know, basically talked to hundreds and I think probably like 1,000 customers over the course of holiday season, we actually ended up making enough revenue to cover our payroll for the first time. And that to us was such an aha moment of, you know what, we actually don't need to rely on VC funding right now to keep our business afloat. We can just, novel idea, build a real business.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, right. Absolutely. Great. And another kind of tangent, but how did you end up getting Gary Vaynerchuk as an advisor? He's pretty in demand, I would imagine.
That was all through Planet of the Apps. So I don't know if you know the format of the show, but essentially you give a 60-second escalator pitch. You know, you're standing on a moving escalator going down towards four celebrity judges. So it's Gary Vaynerchuk, Gwyneth Paltrow, Jessica Alba, and will.i.am. They all have iPads and they swipe right or swipe left if they want to hear more. If all four of them swipe left, you don't even get to demo your app. If at least one of them swipes right, you get to demo your app. And then they ask you questions about your business model. So when we got down to the bottom of the escalator, we found out that all four judges swiped right, and we were able to demo. And then it came down to a bit of a duke out between Gary and Gwyneth. And ultimately, we got Gary as our advisor.
I like both those folks. I think Gwyneth's interesting just as an entrepreneur. Like she's clever. She's smart, you know.
Yeah, it definitely made me weak in the knees when she said that our product was exactly what she wanted and hoped Goop to be.
That's awesome. Fantastic. Okay, so jumping around a little bit more. So how did you end up picking Is Menlo Ventures the lead on that seed round, or did someone else?
Yeah, Menlo's the lead on the seed round, exactly.
You mentioned you had three term sheets. So how'd you end up deciding on them? What was your sort of decision framework, if you can share?
The main thing was that the principal at Menlo, who we're now working with directly, used Journey three times over the last year and really saw the potential in the product and understood it inside and out. A few of the other investors had never even used our product and, you know, felt like they were jumping on board because they knew that, you know, we were getting another term sheet from another, you know, blue chip Silicon Valley investor. So it just felt like, you know, the right fit. They were moving very quickly. The other partners that we were introduced to just got the vision immediately. Whereas with a few of the other investors, you know, I'm getting questions around, you know, how are you going to build the AI? How are you going to build the machine learning? And, you know, one of the senior partners at Menlo, who, you know, has worked on a number of AI startups and been on the board of a number of AI startups, you know, essentially kind of echoing me and saying, you know, you don't even have to explain this. We get it. We've seen this so many times. Once you have the right data set and you have the right data, the AI is a commodity. And, you know, hearing that, understanding that the partners that I was going to be working with have a lot of great experience in the consumer space, in customer acquisition, a lot of the things that, you know, were the biggest things that we saw as things that we needed to work on as a business, that just made it a no-brainer for us.
Yeah. Menlo is a big fund. Was there any sort of thought in terms of like signaling if they don't lead your Series A? Or, I mean, that's one of the questions folks always have, right? If you're pitching these large funds that have a seed program, you know, do you have to worry about that whole signaling risk? Any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think that makes sense. I definitely get that. But at the same time, if this is the best investor who you have in hand, who can help you get to the Series A, then I, you know, don't think it's an issue. And for us too, you know, we had gotten so far on so little funding, and this round ended up being a $1.15 million more than what we had intended to raise. It just felt like that wasn't going to be an issue at all. And also, you know, Menlo, you know, basically told us that they were essentially changing their strategy around seed, right? And instead of kind of writing a number of small checks to, you know, a large swath of seed stage companies, they were focused on changing their strategy and saying, instead of doing that, we want to take a bigger ownership percentage in fewer companies, and we want to write bigger checks at the seed level to justify the time that we're going to spend with them to help them get to the Series A.
Okay. Did they syndicate it to some partners, or did they take the whole round?
So that was a negotiation point. You know, we had some existing investors that, you know, had pro ratas written into their, you know, pre-seed contracts. We also had some new investors that we wanted to bring in. And so they wanted to take pretty much the whole round, but we kind of, you know, had to get them back to a level of ownership that would allow for us to accommodate the other investors that we wanted into the round. So it ultimately ended up being, you know, Menlo Ventures, Pear Ventures, and then a couple of angels, you know, one of them being Jason Wang, who was the founder of Caviar, which was the food delivery startup that sold to Square.
Okay. So again, jumping all over the place, but like, you know, you raised more than you were sort of setting out to, and you mentioned that was one of your bits of advice. But then maybe going back to Fab, right? If I remember Fab's story, they raised a ton of money, grew really fast, kind of imploded. So I guess, what did you learn from Fab days in terms of like raising money, scaling fast versus being more conservative, or what else did you learn from Fab days? Probably a lot.
Yeah, so much. I think, you know, yeah, I think Fab was one of the things that made investors start focusing on the right metrics and really drill down on customer acquisition costs and unit economics. So the year that I joined Fab in 2012, their GMV that year was about $112 million on a product that had a target gross margin of 35%. Meanwhile, 50% of gross merchandise value spend was on marketing. So how do those numbers add up, right? And you know, the joke is like, hey, we'll make it up in volume.
Yeah,
right. clearly that doesn't work out. And so I think one of the big takeaways from that is just, you know, instead of focusing on just the customer acquisition side, and putting yourself in a situation where the more customers you get, the more money you're losing. We really focused on ensuring that we had healthy unit economics so that we would have a solid foundation of a business to then be able to scale. And we, you know, didn't really put the cart before the horse, so to speak.
Yep. Yeah. I know it's, well, I guess you think of Amazon, right? They lost money forever and they're like the one that people point to as the evidence that it can work, but then, you know, lots of others.
Right. That, but how, yeah. But again, it's like, you know, how much money has gone into Amazon and is that going to go into another startup today? And yeah. You know, when you look at how much money has gone into Amazon and Fab pointedly at one point, you know, basically went after and said, we're going to compete with Amazon on logistics, right? Yeah. Remember that conversation? $350 million is nothing.
Yeah. Yeah. Interesting. Do you remember how much they ultimately raised? What was the?
Yeah, it was about $350 million.
Wow. Amazing. But it's still around, I see. I did go to the website beforehand just to see if it was still here.
Yeah, I think it was purchased for something like $15 million by a holding company called PCH that I think didn't really understand e-commerce economics. I know that a number of other companies passed on purchasing Fab. So, you know, it's still around, but it's really not what it could have been. And a lot of, I think, the issues with Fab too were around, you know, moving into Europe too quickly, too soon, were around, you know, going after Amazon's business model and not understanding why the core customer was shopping with Fab. Not investing in the operations of the business. It's very clear when revenue grew 600%, Fab had to grow their people by 600%. Those were just some of the lessons that, you know, I really learned and took away from that experience of making sure that the foundations for a company are sound before you go and scale it. And I certainly know that that's not everyone's take, and there's been a lot of companies that have done it the opposite way and have figured out the operations, you know, after they've gotten scale. But that really only happens when you can go and raise a lot of money. And for us, you know, being in travel and industry that up until very recently, I think investors were still really shying away from, that wasn't an option for us.
Yeah. Yeah. Really good stuff. Well, okay. One or two last questions. I'll let you get back to it. You're clearly a metrics person, which is good. What are you thinking? Do you already have like a target in mind for when it's time to go raise a Series A? Do you have a certain, like, you know, metric target, a revenue target, whatever it might be?
Yeah, I think the typical, you know, metrics for Series A right now, where it becomes, I wouldn't say easy to raise around it, but kind of the right stage to raise around is probably around $500,000 of revenue a month. Mm-hmm. I've talked to investors who have, you know, basically said, hey, when we look at our previous companies and they hit about 250, 300, they have a really hard time closing an A round. But when they hit 500, that's when, you know, it really happens and it's you know, not as difficult.
Yeah. Gotcha. That number keeps going up, doesn't it? I feel like it was not too long ago. It was 100K a month for Series A.
And yeah. I mean, but it makes sense, right? Because the cost of building technology has gone down so dramatically and the barrier to entry of putting up a website or building a product has gone down so dramatically where there's so much more competition now. And so the crux of building a great business is not just around, can you build a great product? It is, can you scale customer acquisition?
Yeah. Very good. All right. Any other lessons learned, things you would do differently, things we haven't covered that you'd like to share today?
Do not ignore your physical wellness.
Oh, interesting. Talk about that. Did you?
Yeah. I mean, I think for about, you know, start like a year and a half ago, I was a constant stress ball. You know, it was not healthy. I was working all the time. I was stressed out all the time. I, you know, didn't have dedicated time away from work. I was always on Slack. I was always checking email. I was always doing something. And, you know, I realized that it just wasn't healthy. When you're building a company and you're building a business that hasn't existed before, it's not about working harder. It's about, you know, having your creative juices flowing and being able to take a step back and look at the big picture of your business. And it wasn't until I hit rock bottom, you know, that time a year and a half ago, almost 2 years ago now, I had $50 in my bank account. It was after that that I took a step back and I said, you know, this isn't healthy, and all I can do is do my best in this business and in running this business, and I'm not going to stress out about it the same way anymore. And that is actually when things started turning around. And I started going to yoga, going to acupuncture, going to the gym, all of those things. And it's just something where I'm happier, my team is happier, we work less hours, but we're more productive. And so I think a lot of entrepreneurs kill themselves over their businesses and feel guilty when they're not spending every waking moment with their businesses. And I would say that, in fact, the opposite is true. You're killing your business if you are not taking time away from it.
I think that's good advice. Yeah. I thought I was getting an ulcer when I was fundraising. Like, I literally thought I was, and turned out it wasn't, but it was debilitating. Yep. Yeah.
Yeah. I still have a vein in my forehead that definitely wasn't there 3 years ago.
Awesome. Okay. Well, Susan, this is great. And if people want to learn more, it's gojourneywithnoe.com, correct?
Yeah. And if people want to try us out for their first trip, I'm going to create a promo code podcast, and we'll give you 20% off your first trip with us.
Cool. What's your favorite city or trip, or I don't know, what do you have, like a favorite, you know?
It's a toss up between Tokyo and Copenhagen.
Oh yeah. Those would be both fun. I love that sushi trip to Tokyo. That sounds amazing. So,
yes, I definitely am the first person to be willing to hop on a plane to go have dinner.
That's awesome. All right, Susan, thank you so much. This is great. Well, good luck. And we'll catch you after your next round.
All right. Thank you. Take care.
Thank you. Bye.
Bye.